Welcome. This is Poetry on the Move. In this episode, the panel What Should Poetry Be? Recorded at the Poetry on the Move Festival held in Canberra in 2019. Page, stage, rage, or sage. There's a lot of opinions on what poetry is and what it should be. Is it an oral art form or pattern language? Is it best heard or read? What is exciting and innovative about the contemporary moment in Australian poetry? To answer these questions, we asked four poets, Eunice Andrada, Kent McCarter, Jeff Page, and Zoe Anderson, to offer their views. We begin with each poet reading some of their own work. First up is Eunice Andrada. Eunice Andrada is a Filipina poet and teaching artist based in Sydney. Her debut poetry collection, Flood Damages, won the Anne Elder Award and was shortlisted for the Victorian Premier's Literary Award for Poetry.
The first time I performed these poems, they were performed in a very intimate room with just me, a cutting board, a knife, a very sharp knife, and some mangoes. and that's because I think it comes from, these poems were mostly written from June to July of this year, and around that time there was a surplus of 10 million mangoes in the Philippines, and that's because there was a really prolonged and really intense El Nino season, and that's when mangoes thrive. And just thinking about that, but also being from a very climate-vulnerable country, but living in Australia, which is the biggest exporter of coal in the world, it's something you carry with you every day, that ecological trauma in the body. So I've been thinking of that as I've been writing these poems. Instead of finding water, I divine juice from a yellow stone fruit. My foraging's habitual, without the silver nitrate needed to mend my womb. I am ancestor of microplastic, enough radiation to birth more chemical soil where we tumble, burp, play alive. I suppose a life after mine will still be a life, though to whom will I describe the delicate sugar of mangoes, or the exact way to strike the fullest part of a watery fruit to hear its age? I am a forgetful maker, leaving my coy futures in the corner to spoil. I was going to make the bed. I was going to make myself last. This is the second poem. It's called Hilot, which is a traditional form of Filipino healing. It cannot be undone when a knife hews its image too close to the bone. You take the blade from me, knock the tip against the pit, swathed in a thin blanket of meat. I think of her shrouded musculature when she would ask me to make a raft of her body. My bare feet press into the supple flesh of her back, lower into decades of hard labor until her forest of sinew confesses by gravity. She would ask me to stop by saying she didn't want me to tire. Here, in this moment, I offer you the sliver of amber, suckling on a glistening cheek, its hairy fibers hanging from my fingers. These aren't your favorite kind. You gnaw on the pit, prying flesh from bone. You're already elsewhere. The third poem. The droning El Nino watches the islands turn themselves inside out to reveal the president's teeth rotting, Israeli medical instruments on his skin rotting, his death squads rotting, the West Philippine seabed rotting, US Army bases rotting. 10 million Carabao mangoes return to stone. After the final El Nino and the super typhoon it pries from the sea, our islands inhabited by nothing but fruit flies. Thank you.
Next, Kent McCarter. Kent McCarter is the CEO, Managing Director, Creative Director, and Publisher of Cordite. He is a writer and editor who lives in Castlemaine with his wife and son, and is the author of three poetry collections, In the Hungry Middle of Here, Sputnik's Cousin, and California Sweet.
I'm going to read three excerpts from a much longer prose poem. It's pretty dark stuff, and it's called Fat Chance. It's got about 20 parts, and I'm going to read these three for right now. Fat Chance. 16 August 1987. A Northwest Airlines DC-9-82 passenger jet crashed on takeoff from Detroit Metropolitan Wayne County Airport, Michigan. Cecilia Chacon's flight lifted off the runway at 170 knots and immediately began rolling from side to side just under 50 feet above the ground. Her flight then stalled, spiraled 40 degrees to the left, and sliced a light pole in half near the end of the runway, brutally hacking off 18 feet of the left wing and igniting a tank of jet fuel stored there. The plane then swung 90 degrees back to the right, where its other wing gouged through the roof of an Avis car hire building, severing and igniting the other wing tip. With that counterforce, the plane fully inverted and flew about 1 kilometer upside down above Middle Belt Road's evening traffic, while fire billowed from each of its severed wing stumps. Then the jet arced downward onto the road, hitting two vehicles, decapitating both drivers, and smacked through a railroad bridge's support abutment. This impact effectively quartered the plane, retarding its pace, with the quarters finally stopping as each, in concert, rammed into a highway overpass and crumpled for good into unrecognizable char. Cecilia was discovered, still buckled intact into her seat, unburnt, perfectly upright in the middle of Interstate 94, alert and conscious with the in-flight magazine in her hands. She was 4 years old. Of the 154 other passengers and crew, the largest piece of discernible human remains after Cecilia was half of a woman's palm, with three fingers still attached. Dental records were ineffective. Part two. Jennifer Strange was among 18 people who entered the Hold Your Wee for a Wee competition, held by KDND, an FM radio station in Sacramento, California. The contestants were to drink as much water as they could without urinating in a bid to win a Nintendo Wii video game console. Jennifer drank over 2 gallons of water in 3 hours. During the contest, a female disc jockey at KDND asked her co-host, "Can you get water poisoning?" "Not with water," her male co-host replied. "Your body is 98% water. Why can't you just take in as much water as you want?" "Maybe we should have researched this before, the female disc jockey said. Jennifer Strange's daughter was 11 months old when her mother doubled over and dropped just hours after coming in a close second place, winning 2 movie tickets and poisoning herself with what seemed to be water intoxication, which a local coroner later corroborated. Her husband, Billy, said to investigators of his daughter, "In the brief amount of time she spent with Jen, she really picked up on a lot of her qualities." At 107.9 on the dial, the station was named The End, honoring the last band in the FM broadcasting range. Its format was contemporary pop and soul. And the last one I'll read. Christmas Eve, 1971. The remains of a Lancia Lockheed L-188A Electra turboprop sprinkled over the mountainous terrain near Puerto Inca, Peru, after a lightning strike disabled the aircraft, causing a mid-air explosion. There had been a very heavy turbulence, and the plane was shimmying violently, luggage, gifts, flowers, and Christmas cakes pinballed around the cabin. The electricity remaining in a fading tropical storm caused St. Elmo's fire, a rare occurrence of a highly charged electrical halo that encapsulates conductive airborne objects around the entire fuselage. The starboard engine disintegrated. Julianne Kepke is currently a professor of biology in Germany. When she was a 17-year-old girl flying with her mother en route to Lima, she found herself trapped into her seat, fully conscious and, at this point, uninjured, hurtling in a parabolic lob from the force of the detonation at 3,500 meters above ground level. "Now it's all over." Those were the final words Kepke ever heard from her mother. The plane then slipped into a free-fall nosedive and broke apart. Her final thought before she eventually passed out was that the rainforest below resembled broccoli. Kepke fell all 3,500 meters down to the rainforest canopy. When she awoke, the seat was upright on the jungle floor with her in it. It was 9 a.m. precisely. Her watch still worked. She was in the Peruvian jungle. Her arms and legs were slashed from branches and her collarbone fractured. When I heard the sounds of running water, I knew I had to follow it because a river would lead to human settlement, she recalled later. Kepke was wearing a very short, sleeveless cotton mini dress, and one of her white sandals remained. Her vision was profoundly myopic, her glasses blown off during her descent. She used her remaining sandal to ascertain the ground ahead of her as she walked, checking for snakes, quicksand, and bogs. She scooped maggots from her wounds and then ate them. She drank muddy water. On her third day, she ran across a three-seat row from the wreckage, upside down and staked about a half meter above the ground. Supporting it were three bodies still buckled in, rammed into the earth up to their shoulders, feet sticking upwards, their heads had acted as arrowheads upon impact. Kepke followed the meandering river through the jungle for 10 days before being found by a lumberman from a remote settlement. They first took her for a water goddess from a tribal legend, a hybrid of water dolphin and a blonde, white-skinned woman. Two of the 92 passengers survived the explosion and 3,500-meter fall into the jungle, Kepke and her mother. Fewer than half of the bodies were recovered. The mother's body was recovered on 12 January 1972. The coroner found that she too had survived the impact, but had been too badly injured to walk. She died of dehydration in the rainforest. Thank you.
Jeff Page is based in Canberra and has published 23 collections of poetry, as well as two novels and five verse novels. His recent books include Gods and Uncles, Hard Horizons, and In Medias Res. His latest book, Elegy for Emily, a Verse Biography, was published in 2019.
As some people know, I don't always read my emails attentively, and I slightly misunderstood how this was all going to work. But I'm happy to adjust. I'm just going to read two poems of mine, and I might, in the latter part, I might read a couple of other poems by other people that might illustrate a couple of points with me. So one serious and one less serious. Many people have heard these before, but I hope not everyone. Anyway, a poem should be heard more than once. We all agree on that? A good poem, anyway. The Open Field. Now, on the other side of 60, you're like an open field. Soon the disabilities will start to sprinkle down those fancy Greek and Latin tags. The same low isobars will bring the illnesses as well, that list of diminutions. The bloodstream, once a freeway, is now a cul-de-sac. The heart taps out its hapless morse. A great metropolis of nerves is slowly frozen over, and cancers sotto voce make their covenants of pain. When clouds like these hang overhead, you know, you're just an open field waiting for the rain. I wrote that when I was younger. So that poem, people often laugh at that, and that's all good too. I intended it seriously, but the imagery is sort of a bit extreme, perhaps, you know, for those of us who are more optimistic. This is hopefully a satirical poem, and may offend some people, but not too badly. It's called 0000. Thanks for calling 4x0 on your snazzy mobile phone. We offer you a unique chance to remonstrate with God alone. Press 1 if you are badly tempered. Press 2 if you require an answer to why the deeply pious seem to be more vulnerable to cancer. Press 3 if you would like to speak to certain saints well placed to beg a favour from the man on high. Press 4 if you've a broken leg. Press 5 if you are just divorced. Press 6 if you are sad and lonely. Press 7 if you've grown obese. Press 8 if you have $5 only. Press 9 for all unhappy childhoods. If still unsatisfied, dial 10. Thanks for calling 4x0. To hear these options once again. I'll talk more later.
And finally, we'll hear from Zoe Anderson. Zoe Anderson is a performance poet who is fascinated by ecology, place, and creating new folklore for a changing world. Zoe's debut poetry collection, Under the Skin of the World, was published by Ampersand Duck in 2020.
In my first poem, I was really so excited to get to hear Eunice's poetry today, because a lot of my poetry thinks about what our landscape will look like or does look like under climate change, and this first poem is about that. On these hot nights, sleep doesn't come till hours after midnight. She lies in bed with the hum of the fan standing sentry, has to wake every hour to drink water. She imagines all the moisture slowly leaving her body, imagines herself drying, her body growing lighter, wrinkling in its shrinking, everything in her evaporated to a dry husk by dawn. She imagines all the moisture slowly leaving this land, puddles, ponds, creeks, rivers disappearing, wetlands and swamps becoming ashy, brittle, gone. She tosses in the living hot night, casts her mind upstream to the catchment, lucky land left uncleared, left alone to flourish. Bush scrub acts as sponge and earth mat, filters rainfall, holds shallow soil together. The night is bloated, baked with lack of sleep. She drives out of town, follows winding roads across narrow bridges, leaves the car, climbs a fire trail, step by steep step. In the cool dawn, she stands above a broad built wall. Eyes roam over flat fastness, over safe stored gigalitres, as if absorbing moisture, she feels her body relax, sure of this one thing for now. Thank you. All right, I think I'll just do one more poem because I'm really excited to find out what poetry is, which is what comes next. And this one is about another space in the ACT. It's a frost hollow, which is in out towards Belconnen. You might know it, but this poem is going to describe it to you. Stand here and see. The landscape, a bowl. Cold air falls, sinks down to pool, in hollow, in mist, in frost. The crisp air amassed. This is where the snow gums grow. Stand here, this place. Its tip touches deep time, This stand of trees gave birth to trees. This stand stood here since each tree reaches back to the last ice age. Back to the land, here, whole, cold, crowned with snow gums. Hear the roar of cars along the expressway, a meeting of four arterial highways, a crossroads. And she comes to the frost hollow each time she has to make a choice in life, to stay, to go, to take a leap of faith, decisions based in heart or hope or health. She takes her question to the snow gums, to the crossroads, to the traffic's constant stream, to the ever-changing immutability of the trees. Because she was born in the crisis, grew up playing in erosion gullies, never known a grassland that wasn't deflated, overgrazed. She was born into the middle, or perhaps the end. Lived so much of her life in drought, the sound of rain makes her nervous, a tap that's been left to run. She was born into the crisis, and she cannot choose to leave the crisis, and she doesn't know what to do. Decisions in the crisis seem futile, thin, unclear. All she can do is stand here and see the landscape, a bowl. Cold air falls, sinks down to pool in hollow, in mist, in frost, the crisp air amassed. This is where the snow gums grow. Thank you.
Now on to the discussion, moderated by Melinda Smith.
So just going by that beautiful sample of everyone's work, we've got an emerging kind of diversity across the poems that have been presented. We have, for example, I know in fiction it's called cli-fi. Do we now have a cli-po? I mean, people talk about echo poetry. And one of the concerns of eco poetry is the impact of climate change. But I find it really interesting that both Zoe and Eunice chose to share poems on those themes. And then we have a kind of another strand of non-fiction, which runs through several of the works that were shared this afternoon, and particularly, I suppose, Kent, we would call it extreme non-fiction, or maybe horror non-fiction. Non-fiction, but incredibly detailed imagining that verges onto kind of where horror and fiction meet as well. And we have also, you know, a focus on more kind of traditional concerns of poetry, a focus on mortality. And even in Jeff's work, we had some rhyme and some form coming through, which was still experienced as fresh and interesting by everyone in the room. So with all that kind of diversity as a bit of a bedrock, I wanted to now ask each of our panelists to talk about what excites them about poetry in this moment, what things are happening in poetry that get them interested. You can also talk about things that annoy you or things that are driving you with things other than excitement in your poetry. But I just kind of wanted to keep it a quite expansive discussion rather than shutting it down into what poetry should be, because I don't think, you know, even though it's a room full of poets, I don't think any of us knows the answer to that question. So I might start with you, Eunice. What's exciting you at the moment, or what would you like to get passionate about?
I'll talk about the things I'm excited about first, and we can talk about the things that annoy us all later. What you mentioned before about the growing movements of eco-poetry in the country is really, it's really exciting to me. Not to say that eco-poetics hasn't existed in Australia, but I think that in the Anthropocene, more focus is being drawn towards the ecopoetics of poets like Stuart Cook and Bruce Pascoe, Michelle Kyle, because there are so many voices that delve into the work of ecopoetics all around the world, from indigenous poets like Craig Santos Perez in Guam, from the US and Samoa. And I think that only now the momentum is really building. In the performance aspect of it, I come from the, I wouldn't call myself a spoken word poet, but I come from that tradition. That was the community that raised me up as a poet. I think it's really exciting seeing so many young women performing at the moment, and women with so much vision as well. Poets like Shastra Deo, for example, who works on the page, but also is a really brilliant performer and is also developing a game. No, she's developing a poem that you can play as a game.
A gamified poem,
as
yeah.
A game. And I just want to talk about all the people I love. and all the, like, Anissa Nandala, who's from Melbourne, and poets developing theater shows and sort of verging into so many different public spaces. So that's really exciting for me.
That's fabulous. You've covered a lot of ground in that for us. And you've raised a point about kind of technology and IT, which I want to get back into a little bit later on too. But Kent, what's driving you, making you excited or otherwise at the moment?
Is that on?
Yeah.
Okay. I do see a lot of poems coming across my desk, and whether it's eco-poetry or identity poetics, which is having a great heyday right now and is well overdue. I guess I read and approach poetry more mechanically and mathematically, and the poems that really appeal to me strike me in that they have been written kind of in 3D, and the excerpts that I read earlier are kind of an example of what I mean. If I were to have read just one of those, I'm just really telling you something that's a fact. It's a collection of 25 true story accounts of people dying, or of people dying ignominiously, or of incredible sole survivors of plane crashes. And in isolation, one story is simply just that. It's journalism, really, and I call that a journalism poem. A second dimension is poems that grab me is when it cultivates an emotional or a philosophical response. A lot of poetry that I read is 2D, and there's some astonishing accomplishments there. I guess I'm most piqued in 3D when there's very clear and deliberate representation or enunciation of a symbol, words on a page, on a canvas, or spoken, and where there is some clear thought on how it's been arranged or said, which really appeals to me. And so that can be across any range of topics. But that's the kind of the work that really is standing out to me right now.
Thanks so much, Kent. So I'm going to keep going along the line and ask Jeff to hold forth and tell us what's exciting him at the moment.
That's a big question, isn't it? I try not to be too excitable, but I don't have to try too hard often. But I'll just point out maybe that I've been reviewing Australian poetry for 52 years, and I've seen a lot come and go, and a lot of tendencies, and I'm pretty optimistic about the state of Australian poetry as it is now. I've seen it when it was in a more fractured state, and a more depressed state, a less gifted state possibly, but I've seen also periods which were full of poets who were extremely accomplished in technical terms, you know, in traditional technical terms. Great figures like David Campbell and Alec Hope and Judith Wright and Gwen Harwood and Rosemary Dobson and all those people. And I think it's important we don't lose track of them in these new enthusiasms that we have, which are also important, as Kent has already established. And a lot of these things have been waiting to happen for a long time. But I feel that the criteria by which everybody is ultimately judged, not by the Lord necessarily, but by poetry readers over millennia, those criteria don't change so terribly much. New things are taken into account, but most of the judgments, most of the enthusiasm based on things that have been there since Enkidu and, you know, the Epic of Gilgamesh and so forth. So a lot of these things are old and timeless, as well as a new one of the moment. And we don't want to get too carried away with what's in the moment, but we have to keep an eye on the moment. And we are in the moment. Even the older of us are in the moment. And but we don't necessarily take the fashion. People do fall out of fashion. I've seen it happen during people's lives. It certainly happens after their death. Mm. Usually there's sort of a downward situation for about 30 years, and then a few sort of pop up their heads and saying, is it safe to come up, you know? And sometimes it is, you know, and their reputations are restored. But a lot of people just disappear, and that's just the way it's always been. So I won't say more than that. I think that's enough for a start. Okay. Yeah.
I suppose that tension between, you know, tradition and being in the moment that we find ourselves in, I mean, that's an eternal kind of dilemma for the poet. And, I mean, we're all trying to bear witness to what's around us and what we're enmeshed in, or at least that's one way of looking at it. But perhaps, as you say, perhaps what gives a poem its impact, because, you know, we're all human, perhaps there are some aspects to that that are unchanging. So Zoe, as a kind of a poet who straddles the written word and the spoken word, and as a curator of an event that's been giving a platform to voices for a long time, what's exciting you at the moment?
Oh, thanks, Melinda. I think what's exciting me actually in poetry at the moment is the community. So I come from a spoken word community, quite obviously, and I've travelled around Australia as a result of that and even overseas, and just seen how the community really brings people in together and it lifts people up. Pretty much because I think in spoken word, if we want to call it that, it's a newer space, it's maybe slightly less defined, and we don't have rules or any curation at that slam or open mic level. You can just walk in, say you've got a poem, nobody's going to question you. Nobody's going to tell you what poetry is at that moment. You're going to have your 3 minutes or whatever it is in front of the microphone and see what it feels like when you deliver whatever you have to deliver as poetry and have that reflected back at you. And I've seen some really incredible poets come up through and define themselves as artists in that way by having a pretty non-judgmental, very open, very supportive space to begin their artistic career, or maybe to change its direction. And then they've gone on to do amazing collaborations, maybe to tour around the country, to write shows, to have books. Really, it's just kind of a great starting point for whatever else you want to do. So I think that is something that really excites me in poetry at the moment.
Thank you, Zoe. Yeah, you know, I think that idea about community and the fact that spoken word does offer that community, and also the aspect of welcoming atmosphere and safety. I mean, for any artist to get going, I think you need to feel that it's okay to fail, and it's okay to just try, and to have a place where it's safe to do that, possibly week after week or month after month, I think is incredibly important for any art form. So the fact that that is happening in poetry at the moment and is happening so much says a lot about the kind of the... If you're talking about a garden and the soil health, I think the soil health is really good, and the kind of the turning over is happening, and there's a lot of organisms in the soil that are working away and producing great artists who kind of turn up week after week and see what they can do. So thank you all for sharing that kind of initial idea about what's exciting you. There was another question I wanted to throw out there, and feel free to jump in if you have anything to say about it. As well as living in the Anthropocene, we're kind of living in what may end up being quite a brief end of humanity blip, the internet age. And that brings with it a lot of challenges for the way that we relate to each other as humans, but it also brings with it the ease or new ways of sharing poems, new ways of making poems into hybrid art forms and transmitting them. And I'm just wondering if any of those things have piqued your interest, or you've seen things that you might like to try and experiment with. Maybe I'll start at the other end this time, Zoe, and give you an in. There's a project I know that we're both involved in that looked like going ahead that maybe isn't in the current form now, but maybe you could talk about what your ideas might have been for that project.
True. Thanks for throwing me a line. I thought I'd have all of this time to think of an answer, and you threw me under the bus, Melinda. I've seen some pretty amazing digital poetry hybrids or directions. I feel like Going Down Swinging, that Melbourne publication, often has some quite interesting online things that you can kind of click through, and they do various illustrated things that I'm bad at describing with my words. Melinda and I were going to be, and hopefully still will be, involved in a collaboration with Karen Florence and Jackie Marlins, where we were going to use augmented reality. Now, I don't know if you know what augmented reality is, but it's like Pokemon Go, where you hold up your phone camera and it feeds something onto your screen, but it'll overlay that with other images or words or perhaps sounds, and so it'll be responding to what your phone camera is seeing, but it will be putting other things on top. And so we will hopefully be writing poems and then getting illustrations and laying over those illustrations what the phone camera is bringing in. I don't know if I'm making any sense because I'm not an expert in this, but we sat down and had this very exciting conversation and thought, oh, you know, you could do all sorts of illustration, you can think about found sounds in that, and you can really situate a poem in the landscape or in the space where the audience happens to be, which is a very exciting thing, seeing as the poet isn't necessarily there to deliver it. It's all happening through the medium of a screen. So that's something that's quite fun. Hopefully we'll see more of that in the future. I think that's about all I have to say on that.
Thank you for giving us that little insight, Zoe. It's just I figured since you were going to be on the panel, I might ask you that question. Does anyone of the other panellists want to jump in and talk about kind of what technology is or isn't changing about the way you consume poetry or the way you curate poetry of other people?
Well, I've had a lot of interest in machined poetry, and that's not a new thing, although in the last 20 or 30 years, its breadth has widened. And one of the most fascinating practitioners of that is Mez Breeze, and she lives in Goulburn, but she is a world-renowned game developer, poet, has invented her own coding languages, has invented her own written languages, and then to have invented your own language and then to warp it in a way for a poetic outcome, I find fascinating, and a highly, highly underrated artist and thinker in Australia. But machine poetry such as my friend and colleague Karen Florence, in her most recent book, where there is visual poetry, but it is highly articulate in how it works and what it means, and there's a lot of backstory behind it. So there's a lot of diversity going on. Obviously, you can do a lot of things online now with video poems and sound poems and mashing them together, and that opens up a big window for I think the identity poetry right now, and that's something that I talked to quite a bit with the poet Omar Saker, who I published a couple of years ago, and he has a lot of just booming energy, and needed an outlet for that, and we've recorded a couple of things that have not gone online yet, but it's a that kind of machinery helps to get the depth and the sound and the person through and the work as well. So lots going on there.
Yeah. That segues quite nicely into something I was going to ask Eunice. Am I correct in understanding you've got a kind of film poetry project in the works?
Who sent you?
I could tell you, but I'd have to kill you. Only talk about that if you're comfortable. Otherwise, just talk about what you were going to say.
Sure. I don't know how you found that out, but I am trying to work on a series of video poems to do with eco-poetics. I was going to tack on to what Kent was saying also about just the impact of video poetry, but also how the internet in general is just such a powerful tool for marginalized voices to reclaim space, especially if they're not granted that space in spaces like this. Like social media platforms and video poetry on YouTube is such an important way for poets to be able to reclaim that space and that agency and the voice that they're often denied. So, yeah, I mean, I could talk forever about the internet. I fucking love the internet. But yeah, on the topic of video poetry, I found that from the videos I've posted online from years ago, the reason that I wanted to continue creating video poems is because I can see the continuing impact it has on so many communities around the world. Young students from Norway, from the Philippines, from the US, and researchers have found those videos of me online and have contacted me saying how inspiring those videos were, or they wanted to write more about those videos. And it just, I think it's so exciting to be able to expand your audience so much and to reach and move so many people beyond a stage, beyond your local stage and onto the internet. But yeah, that video series is in the works this year, and hopefully to add to that momentum of eco-poetics in Australia and the Philippines.
That's very exciting.
Is a video of poetry a video of somebody inside of?
I'll just say Lois's question so the rest of the audience can hear. So Lois asked, is video poetry a video of the poet reciting their poem? Or and Eunice, maybe you'd like to talk to that.
Yeah, that's one way of presenting video poetry. It could be a filmed recording of the poet performing or reciting their work. Or it could be, I think there are so many ways that performers are presenting their work online now, whether it's through sort of incorporating other things like augmented reality in that space and into the YouTube space, or using Instagram TV as video spaces as well.
And I think, I suppose it depends on the skills of the poet involved, whether they source images from, you know, like they just basically go and get stock footage from somewhere, or whether they actually work with an artist or a filmmaker to create the visuals for the kind of the temporal aspect of the video poem. Have you worked with people, or do you make your own images when you use?
Previously, I have worked with like proper film crews to make videos.
That sounds like a good plan. So, there was one other thing that I thought maybe before we open up to audience questions, I might just lob into the mix. So Joel Dean, the Melbourne poet, gave a speech at the Melbourne Writers' Festival recently called the Peter Steele Oration. And it's pretty broad as to subject matter, but he chose to use some of his speaking time to talk about the state of Australian poetry. He tongue-in-cheek called the whole speech a combi van full of koalas because he kind of likened the smallness of the Australian poetry scene and also the possible tenor of the interactions between poets to a combi van full of koalas. But he was speaking in a kind of call for unity space, and he was speaking in a way to kind of give everyone a bit of perspective. And I'd just like to kind of quote some of the things that he said about poetry in Australia. Every poet lives on the literary margins. We're all marginal. And he was saying this as a poet at a literary festival at which there were not very many poetry events, so he was kind of knew whereof he spoke. It's just that some of us are more marginal than others. And if we want to ever be anything other than marginal, we need to stop behaving like the jets and the sharks in West Side Story. Because to extend the metaphor, we can't fight, we can't dance, and we're shit choreographers. I'm kind of annoyed that I don't live in Melbourne and I couldn't have seen that speech live. I would have liked to see how it went down as well. Another metaphor for Australian poetry that I have heard bandied about is a knife fight in a phone booth. A number of people want to claim credit for that, so I'm not going to say the list of people who claim credit for it, but whoever came up with it first, it's fabulous. Oh, of course, yes. I've seen other people since try and take credit for it, but you're right, John Forbes probably was the first. No one's packing any knives. We've checked everyone on the way in. So there's going to be no knife fighting in this phone booth this afternoon. But I'm interested in, I suppose, the impetus behind Joel's comments and the kind of call to unity. He did also use his time to say that Australian poetry is undergoing a purple patch at the moment, by which I think he meant it's very robust and healthy, and with any robust, healthy art form, you're going to get kind of struggle over capital and position and so forth. But I'm just interested to kind of throw it open to our panellists and see if they have any thoughts on the combi van full of koalas model, or whether it's actually not like that from where they sit. I'm going to go for Jeff first, because I missed him out when we were talking about the last thing. So it's your turn, Jeff.
Now, I read that speech and I do get to mention it. And another phrase that was used, I think Richard Tipping had the phrase, a shoebox full of grasshoppers. That was perhaps more benign. But talking about the 52 years of reviewing Australian poetry, there have always been these divisions. You know, they go back into the 40s or they go back into the 20s. You know, so it's not new, but the sort of no man's land has changed significantly over time. And it's been quite interesting to follow and to some extent participate. I always tried to stand back from it and try to have a bet each way and not make too many enemies. But I do have certain clear aesthetic principles, and they do agree with some people more than other people, and everybody else is really in that situation as well. So a certain amount of conflict is inevitable if you get a group of people who hold sincere convictions about aesthetics. You know, you're going to get some disagreement. We were going to talk at one stage, weren't we, about the different tendencies in Australian poetry at the moment.
Feel free to say.
Well, in this notorious review that I wrote of this book called Solid Air, which I thought was a relatively benign review, but I detect when I reread it there's a sort of tone of condescension which I didn't deliberately put in but snuck out, I think, and that's probably what stirred people up. But in that I made the point in the preamble before I got to any amble, and of course I only had 400 words, as Joel pointed out correctly, that
it was
my review was all preamble and no amble. And I didn't give many examples, but ironically, he didn't give any examples of the tendency that he approved of. You know, he's saying all these younger emerging poets, like female and other people of colour and so forth. He didn't quote a single name to illustrate his point, let alone a stanza. And I'm inclined to think that that's quite a plausible viewpoint. It's just a pity he had 5,000 or 6,000 words and he didn't illustrate it. I had 400 and I didn't illustrate it.
I see.
So, don't get me started, but no. I think that's probably enough for the moment. But I'll just say, division is inevitable. If it's sincerely held and people are coherent and they don't use violence, then that's probably okay. But Joel's right in a sense, there's no point in us our disagreeing so strongly, because we are a minority within a minority. We're a niche within a niche within a niche, and which doesn't mean that we're all in exactly the same position. The smaller the niche, the more people fight over it. That's a sad thing. And people in other minorities discover that as well. You know, the conflicts within those minorities can be quite intense. Yeah. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. Did you want to say something?
Yeah. I think I agree with what the quote was saying to an extent, that there is so much fighting for space in Australian poetry at the moment, which is really unhealthy, but the other really toxic thing is when other poets try to attack the legitimacy of poets who are in another form, like spoken word or slam poetry. I think that's quite classist and elitist to do that. And I think poets are so up their own asses sometimes because it's all just poetry. It's so arbitrary to have this delineation between spoken word and slam and page poetry and all these really tiresome debates. I think I see it every festival, page versus stage, let's debate. Yeah. And it's so tiring. Yeah. I think we need to be able to create space for each other and hopefully not attack each other's legitimacy as poets. I think that would create a more healthy landscape of Australian poetry.
That's very interesting and valid words. Oh, woo.
There is definitely a lot of auto-colonoscopy going on.
I'm totally stealing that.
I guess I'm kind of in a unique platform where I can reflect that. On Friday and Saturday nights, we coordinate poetry review. We quite frequently will get a lot of drunk submissions from people and reactionary comments. And I've been able to, it's irrelevant from who or what, but I've been able to isolate the time and then erstwhile remembrances when poems were not accepted and we were accused of never having had them in the first place. But anyway, it's kind of when the vitriol comes out, and there's definitely a notable population of poets who are absolutely terrified of performance poetry, and on the other hand, who are absolutely terrified of poetry that doesn't have any narrative. Both exist, and both are meritorious. I don't believe that a poem needs to have a voice. It doesn't need to have a story or a narrative. In the way that I have been to the Met and looked at a beautiful painting of Andrew Wyeth in a farmhouse and sweeping wheat fields, abstract paintings move me as much or more. So I think there's room for that. But there is a clear uncoiling of people terrified of the academy of poetry, that it should be only performance and spoken word and song of the jester of over hundreds of years, and that is an accurate thing. I do agree with Joel that it's koalas in a combi. I guess I will kind of take one issue with Joel, is that I'm not marginalized. I'm a native English-speaking, straight, white, middle-aged male with two business degrees. I'm like the absolute bullseye of what diversity isn't. And so I think that to be able to create space and to offer opportunity for additional voices to come to the fore is still very important in Australian poetics. And I think it's a bit too soon to start, for lack of a better term, whitewashing that into koalas in a combi, because it's still fairly recent, and there's a lot of work to go there.
Yeah, I think that interesting thing about the jockeying for space is that there's some spaces that have not been available, and that it's incumbent on all of us to work harder to make those spaces more porous to people who haven't been able to be in them, and to make new ones, and to pass the mic to someone else and say, go make your own space, I will back you up from here, and I will keep the other koalas away for long enough for you to do what right. You need to do.
Definitely no drunks and submitting.
and friends don't let friends submit drunk.
I had one just the other day where it was rejected, and we got a vitriolic email back saying, I didn't submit in the first place. And of course, we have a record of the time and the date and from who, and it's lo and behold about 1:37 a.m. on Friday night, Saturday morning, as they always are about that time. So, Careful with that.
That's really, no, that's a view into the world of the online poetry journal that I did not know existed. So Zoe, you look like you wanted to say something just then. Would you like to step in?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think everyone's made a lot of really good points. And certainly as a young-ish person stepping into this poetry space, what, 5 or 7 years ago, you do immediately start to feel the tension between page and stage and what poetry is and what poetry should and shouldn't be. And I like to laugh about it with my friends sometimes about how small this world actually is and how nobody else cares. It's just us. But I think it's also really important that we take a good hard look at ourselves and to make sure that we're not carrying on any of those prejudices and putting that onto new people entering the scene or people who don't write like us, look like us, speak like us, act like us. So that's just what I wanted to say to finish up that point.
This has been Poetry on the Move, with a panel from the 2019 Poetry on the Move Festival, What Should Poetry Be? Thanks to Eunice Andrada, Kent McCarter, Jeff Page and Zoe Anderson, and to Melinda Smith, who moderated the panel. This podcast is made possible by IPSI, the International Poetry Studies Institute, and the Centre for Creative and Cultural Research, Faculty of Arts and Design at the University of Canberra. My name is Shane Strange. Thank you for listening.